This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. In a speech to a joint meeting of Congress earlier today, Iraq's interim prime minister, Iyad Alawi, painted an upbeat picture of his country. He said elections could be held today in 15 of the country's 18 provinces, that elections will be held on time in January, that almost 50,000 Iraqi troops are combat ready today, the number he said would rise to 250,000 by the end of next year, and that despite setbacks, daily life and the economy are improving.
Across the country, there is a daily progress too. Oil pipelines are being repaired. Basic services are being improved. The homes are being rebuilt. Schools and hospitals are being rebuilt. The clinics are opened and reopened. There are now over 6 million children at school, many of them attending one of the 2,500 schools that have been renovated since liberation. Last week, we completed a national polio vaccination campaign, reaching over 90% of all Iraqi children. We're starting work on 150 new health centers across the country. Millions of dollars in economic aid and humanitarian assistance from this country and others around the world are flowing into Iraq. For this, again, I want to thank you.
Following his address to Congress, Prime Minister Alawi went to the White House to meet with President Bush. At a joint news conference, the Prime Minister was asked how his upbeat assessment squares with the rebellion based in the city of Fallujah, where Sunni fundamentalists rule in open defiance of the government in Baghdad.
We cannot really substitute Iraq for Fallujah. Fallujah is a small part of Iraq. There are insurgents and terrorists who are active there for geographical reasons. The people of Fallujah are adamant that they should, whenever they are capable, to get rid of the insurgents. We have been talking to them. I have been talking to them, engaged in dialogue. My deputy met with the Fallujah tribes 2 days ago. Things are moving in the right direction, and we are hitting insurgents and terrorists in this part of the world. To have more troops, we don't need. What we need really is to train more Iraqis, because this is ultimately for Iraqis, for Iraqi security forces to take responsibility for their own security and to defend the rest of the civilized world.
Prime Minister Alawi and President Bush's optimism comes amid other and bleaker assessments of the situation. Leaks of a CIA estimate and a study by a respected British defense think tank both warned of a very real possibility of civil war in Iraq. UN Secretary General Kofi Annan said earlier this week he has doubts that security can be improved quickly enough to allow elections to be held on time. And all of us see and read and hear reports of suicide bombs, kidnappings, and ambushes, and a mounting death toll. In addition to the unresolved crisis in Fallujah and other cities in the Sunni Triangle, U.S. forces continue to battle forces loyal to the Shiite cleric Muqtada al-Sadr in Baghdad. We'll talk today with three guests intimately familiar with different aspects of Iraq. Jack Keane, who retired as acting chief of staff of the U.S. Army. He was in Iraq earlier this month. Jay Garner, the former U.S. administrator in Baghdad, and Rajiv Chandrasekaran, the Baghdad bureau chief for the Washington Post. If you have questions about what's happening in Iraq and the way ahead, our phone number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. You can also email us, TOTN at NPR.org. And good to welcome Jack Keane back to our studios. General Keane, welcome back to Talk of the Nation.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
What were you doing in Iraq? And tell us what it was like. What did you see?
Well, I spent about 9 or 10 days mostly looking at the security situation and the training of the Iraqi security forces and giving an assessment of that to General Casey. Felt very good about my visit. I'm encouraged, certainly, by Prime Minister Alawi, his strength. You can see that in his testimony today before the Congress and the leadership, particularly, he's providing to the Iraqi people, the straight talk that he provides to them. He talks to them in phrases like, look, the Americans have given us this freedom. It's a gift they've given to us. They've shed a lot of blood doing this, but it's up to us. We have to stand up. You've got to get off the fence and make a commitment to a free Iraq. They can help us do it, but the responsibility is ours. So it's delightful to see a strong leader coming forward Who is an Iraqi who's taking charge of his government and inspiring his people?
As you know, sometimes critics describe Prime Minister Alawi, in perhaps somewhat dismissive terms, though, as the mayor of Baghdad. He's not in control of much of the rest of the country.
That's a falsehood. You know, the fact of the matter is you go north, northeast, south, the vast majority outside of Baghdad and the Sunni Triangle. I mean, if I could take you all there, you would be stunned by the normalcy. Markets are teeming with people. Traffic jams rival anything in a major city in America. School kids are going to school. It's just there's a staggering unemployment. I don't want to minimize some of the economic development and the challenges that are there. But there is a sense of normalcy that is outside the area where the Sunnis have support and where they're conducting their insurgency.
Yet we hear reports every day of the number of incidents in Iraq seems to increase with every day. The death toll on all sides is mounting. The insurgency, some say, well, it's a few. Well, it seems the impression is that it is large and getting larger.
Well, this is true. The insurgency itself is a challenge, and I'm certainly not going to minimize that. I think one of the significant challenges that we're facing is the fact that the insurgents have a capacity to regenerate, and they are regenerating, which should give us pause and to recognize that defeating the insurgents, we cannot do it with bullets alone. It's economic development, it's jobs, it's raising the quality of life experience for all of the Sunnis and the Iraqis in general, so that they have some confidence in a free Iraq, so that these youngsters who are 15 to 25 years of age, who have nothing to do, there's an element of hooliganism that's running around there, and also an element of nationalism, that we get them to be able to express their energy and passion into something that's constructive. And that has to be done alongside of the military application has taken place. And that's why reconstruction is important, economic development and jobs are very, very important. And that has been slow in coming, to be frank about it. And I know there's a considerable effort by Ambassador Negroponte and Prime Minister Alawi to move this along.
The reconstruction money that was voted by Congress, for which Prime Minister Alawi was today very thankful to the U.S. Congress, but a lot of that money has not been able to be spent because the security situation is so bad.
Well, some of it was just bureaucratically, it was a problem. It took far too long to get some of these contracts approved. And then, frankly, the contracts themselves were so large in terms of building major industrial plants, et cetera. And what many of the commanders were seeking, and now I think are being effectively listened to, is they wanted smaller projects that would have some direct impact on the people so that the people in the town would see their sewage system fixed, as an example, as opposed to a major industrial plant that's going to drive all of the power out of Baghdad. That's, some of these things have to be done throughout the country in smaller communities to show the people that there is a tangible difference in their lives as we transition from Saddam Hussein and move towards a free Iraq.
Our number, if you'd like to join the conversation, is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. Our guest is Jack Keane, retired as acting Army Chief of Staff, just returned from Iraq, where he was doing an assessment of the situation there. And let's take a call now from Carrie. If I push the button right, there we go. Carrie, I think you're on the line with us now from St. Louis.
I am, and thank you so much for taking my call, and thank you, General, for your service to the Constitution and the country. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
My question is, are there at present enough U.S. troops to provide training to potential Iraqi security forces and the Iraqi people?
Well, I took a look at very closely at the training that's being provided to Iraqi security forces, and I think, you know, honestly, we oversold the Iraqi security forces' capability many, many months ago and created some unreasonable expectations. There is a solid training program that's in place now. Special forces, conventional army soldiers training them. They are being equipped. They're not completely equipped. But the training is right, the equipment is right, and they're vetting the leaders. So I'm hopeful that the Iraqi security forces are going to be able to equip themselves. I'm absolutely convinced after talking to many of their leaders, many of their soldiers, and our people who are training them, that they have the will and the character to fight for their country and their willingness to die for it. And we should, you know, give them obvious credit for that, given some of the repression that they've had in the last 35 years and the loss of confidence that they've had in their country. I'm confident that this, we're moving in the right direction. Look, it's not going to be perfect. You know, we sent 6 battalions into Najd when we had that last incursion there. 4 of them did pretty good, and 2 of them were uneven.
You're talking about 6 Iraqi battalions.
6 Iraqi battalions. We should probably, that's more than an adequate response as far as I'm concerned. Did that answer your question?
It did to a certain extent, but if I could follow up, I'm wondering, you had said, I believe in the willingness. I mean, I hear that Iraqis are very willing to defend their country, but are they being supplied by the U.S.? Is the money that the U.S. citizenry is paying for Iraq going to help the security forces defend Iraq?
Yeah, straight answer is yes. A number of months ago, those contracts took far too long to get approved for that equipment to come in, and that equipment is flowing in now. And they're not crediting an organization of being able to deploy unless it is properly equipped, it's properly trained, and it's properly led. When those three things are in place, then the unit is given to the United States military and to Department of Defense in the Iraqi new government for use. Until those three conditions are met, the unit will not be deployed.
Prime Minister Alawi said today that there are 50,000, almost 50,000 Iraqi troops ready for combat, and that there would be a 250,000 by the end of next year. Those realistic numbers?
I think so. I felt that by spring and summer of next year, they're probably going to be in pretty good shape. And their target is 250,000. I suspect that it may grow closer to 300,000 by the time all said and done. And a very large portion of that number can be misleading, because about 90,000 of those are actually Iraqi police. Initially, they were being trained in a Jordanian police academy, and now they've opened up their own regional police academies as well. And that's a huge challenge for them, because the police have always been corrupt in the past, and they've got to change the culture of what a policeman does and the character of that policeman, their integrity and the like, and they're doing that in an indoctrination program. So out of the 250, just remember about 90,000 are also policemen.
Kerry, thanks for the phone call.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. The critical issue for the Iraqi security situation now is that Sunni Triangle area. There's been heavy attacks in Baghdad and Shia areas the last couple of days. But Fallujah, is Fallujah going to have to be taken before there is going to be an election? And are Iraqi troops going to have to do that?
I don't know if it's essential to be taken before the election. I think as soon as the conditions are right to do that, it should be done, and I would not wait a day longer. And I think the conditions should drive it. And what are those conditions? That you have in place a political leadership that take over that's going to be responsible, a police force that on the ground will be effective with a competent police chief that you can trust. And the Iraqi security forces are prepared to do the lion's share of the work with the United States military assisting them in crushing the insurgents in Fallujah. Now, make no mistake about it, you have to deal with Fallujah. And I think what I'm trying to say is that we should deal with it, but we should make sure the conditions are right to do it, and don't let some other external condition drive us to do something premature.
We are talking with retired General John Keane about the state of Iraq today in light of the address earlier today of Iraq's interim Prime Minister Iyad Alawi to Congress. When we come back from a short break, we're going to hear from a former decision maker in Iraq, retired Army Lieutenant General Jay Garner. He was the first U.S. commander or head of the first coalition administration in Iraq immediately after the war. If you'd like to join us, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Our guest today is Jack Keane, former Army Vice Chief of Staff. He retired as Acting Chief of Staff, just returned from Iraq, where he did an assessment of what's going on there. You're invited to join our conversation. It's 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, or you can email us, TOTN@NPR.org. And joining us now is retired Army Lieutenant General Jay Garner, who served as Director of the Office of Reconstruction and Humanitarian Assistance in Iraq after the war. He's with us by phone from New Smyrna, Florida, where he's getting ready, as I understand it, for the approach of Hurricane Jean.
That's correct.
I hope you manage to avoid it, but we appreciate you taking the time between hammering up plywood to join us today. I wanted to begin by asking you, we've heard upbeat assessments of the situation in Iraq. When you left there, what was it, a year and a half ago or so, did you imagine that the situation would be this bad, this far out?
Oh, I don't think anybody thought that it would be this bad. No, I didn't imagine that at all. None of us thought that we would be without problems, but I don't think anybody predicted anything as bad as we have right now.
Continued problems, and there's been a lot of 2020 hindsight about the decision taken by your successor to disband the Iraqi army, about the decision to put what in retrospect looks like inadequate numbers of forces into Iraq at the time to control the looting and that sort of situation. Would you agree with that?
Well, first of all, yes, I'd agree that those were, as we go back and look at it, number one, our original plans were to bring back the Iraqi army, the regular army, not the Republican Guards, Special Republican Guards. And that was the decision not to do that was a mistake. And then initially, with the amount of troops that we took in there, we thought we were enough. It certainly was enough to win the war, but it appears it wasn't enough to secure the peace.
And let me ask you, and I'd like to hear from General Keane on this as well, do you think there are enough troops now to handle the tasks of security, of training the Iraqi forces, and of controlling Iraq's borders?
Are you asking me or are you asking Jack
Keane? I'm going to ask you both, but why don't you go first, General Garner?
Well, I listened to what Jack Keane said a while ago, and I think he's right on. I think that we need more troops in Iraq, but I'm not sure that they necessarily have to be U.S. troops. I think we, as you bring in more Iraqis, if you can bring in more allies or more coalition, either of those is acceptable. But I do think we probably need more security forces there.
General Keane?
Yeah, I would agree with that. Certainly our people are challenged by training the Iraqi army, being on the border, dealing with the security situation. But our generals have looked at this right from the outset. General Franks did before he left, General Abizaid multiple times, General Casey now. And they've certainly done the troop-to-task analysis to determine whether they need more troops. And if they absolutely felt they needed more, they would ask more and ask for them. I know that for a fact. And I think the reality is that there are Iraqi security forces that are the battalions that are being trained that are going to be effective, and they'll be added to that troop-to-task list, and that's who they're going to use. And it makes sense.
General Garner, I wanted to ask you also, and also, again, Jack Keane, but your assessment of the situation. We've heard both in the leaked report of the CIA National Intelligence Estimate and the Chatham House report that by the British defense think tank that they both warned of a crisis, that might reach civil war. Is that something we should be concerned about at this point?
Well, certainly I think you have to concern yourself with that. I think we're probably missing the major muscle movements. I agree with Jack Keane. There's an awful lot of good going on. There's a lot of good indicators, but there's some things that are very important over there that I think that we need to focus on. Number one, I think we need a foreign policy that begins to negate the immense amount of Iranian influence that we're having, especially in southern Iraq. Number two, I think we have to look at what the future elections are going to be, and whether or not they occur the first year doesn't matter. In the future elections, we have to look at those being shaped in such a way that you don't have an overwhelming Shia majority that leads to fundamental Islamic religious law. So those are two major things. You know, in 1947, Truman went before the Congress, and not a friendly Congress, and he laid down what was a Truman Doctrine to stop communism, essentially stop communism in Greece and Turkey. And we need that right now to stop the Iranian influence in the South. Well, I also agree with Jack Keane. We have to stimulate the economy. Over half of the Arab population is below the age of 20. And that's certainly true in spades in Iraq. And so we have to employ the unemployed youth. They're the most receptive age to incitement, the major group that's involved in violence and unrest. And the only way we're going to stop that is put them to work. We ought to take a page out of Roosevelt's Depression Administration and analyze the way that we used America's youth in national projects and not only employ the youth, but restore the economy and it provided a new infrastructure to the nation. We need to do more things than we're doing right now. We need to do some major things. We need a Truman-type doctrine to stop outside influence. We need a Marshall-type plan to stimulate the economy, eliminate the debt, harness the oil revenues, et cetera, et cetera.
Mm-hmm. But specifically, let me ask you about the concerns of the Kurdish minority in northern Iraq. You had considerable experience with them with during Operation Provide Comfort after the first Gulf War. And these are people very concerned that they may find themselves in a permanent minority in, they're going to be in a minority in Iraq no matter what happens, but they fear that their autonomy that they've enjoyed ever since 1991 is going to be considerably eroded.
Well, they're not going to allow that to happen, I don't think. The Kurds aren't. But you put your finger on one of the most important things. The problem we have over there right now is we've attempted to take a Western template for democracy and try to implant that on Iraq, and you can't do that. I mean, it doesn't apply there. What they really need is a form of federalism. I think Peter Gilbert wrote a few articles back in May, but we need sort of federal entities. One is you already have one Kurdistan. The next one could be the Sunni Triangle, and you have the Shias in the south. And that conglomerate of unrest in Baghdad, all those could be federal entities. And inside those entities, they could have their own paramilitary forces, their security forces, their own religion, their own language, their own education, health benefit system, that type of thing. Mm. And then over that, you'd have a weak central government that raises a small army, seal the borders, it provides taxation, it sends somebody to the UN, sends somebody to OPEC, it decides the currency issues, that type of thing. But I think what we could all agree on right now is in today's Iraq, none of the three major religious or ethnic forces, the Sunnis, the Shia, the Kurds, are going to allow themselves to be controlled by the other. And so I think what we need is sort of a democratic federalism and federal entities and a weak government. And that's not, we should be used to that. You know, the last time I remember that being successful was something called the 13 colonies and the Articles of Federation, because that's the way we started, and we walked slowly into democracy. Now, you look at Kurdistan really is a beacon in the Middle East. They've made excellent headway toward a stable environment. They got a good market economy up there. They have minority rights. Many of their leaders are women, and they have a relatively good democracy. And so if all else fails, the one thing we need to do is support Kurdish autonomy. Because the Kurds, along with Turkey and Israel, are the only democracies in the Middle East. So it's very important to focus on them. We haven't focused on them. We've turned our backs on the Kurds, and they've been our allies. They've been our allies all along, and they still have very, very strong sentiment and good regard for the United States.
Should be pointed out the Kurds had some problems of their own along the way, including a little civil war. But General Keane, are these issues of unity and possible, federalism, as Jay Garner calls it, are they under discussion in Iraq today among commanders?
Well, I don't think there's anybody in government or outside of it that is truly interested and committed to what's taking place in Iraq that can predict what's going to happen here. In terms of the Kurds, the Sunnis, and the Shias' commitment to live in harmony and to have some kind of an effective government, that question is unknown. That's the reality of it, and it's a big unknown. But look, we can be encouraged by some of the steps that have already been taken and the way these three groups have come together despite their differences and despite some of their protestations in the process. The fact is, we have stood up a sovereign government. They have stood up the equivalent to our Bill of Rights. They are putting together a National Assembly. There is going to be an election. I think there'll be considerable challenges down the road. I agree with Jay that probably what will come out at the end will not be something that looks exactly like America. But that's okay. It's going to be their solution to their challenge and their problems. And it's not our place to impose governmental solution on them. They're in a process that they're participating in, and we have to be encouraged by the moderation that the Shias have shown, despite Zarqawi's clear intent to inflame a civil war. And you also have to respect the moderation that the Kurds have shown as well. They are clearly looking to a greater Iraq as being more important at times than their own individual expectations as a religious group or as a political organization. And that is what a democracy is all about. It is the protection of the minority. So I'm encouraged by some of the steps, but still a lot of challenge ahead, and I don't think anybody knows what this outcome is going to be.
Let's get a caller on the line. Karen joins us from San Diego.
Hi.
Hi.
This is very interesting. I was wondering, we have a lot of people over there trying to rebuild their infrastructure. Why don't we give them that responsibility, give them the jobs? Well, no man feels like he's much of a man unless he's got a job and can support his family. That is like triple so in the Middle East. And the longer we're there and the more they see that we're rebuilding their schools, we're rebuilding their infrastructure, and we're doing jobs that they could do perfectly well themselves.
Mm-hmm. Well, Jack Keane?
Yeah. Well, I completely agree with you. Many of our commanders for a long time and now have been listened to. What they were saying is, look, don't come in here with a major engineering project with all your fancy machinery and build a structure for us. What I really want you to do is give me some money and some people that know how to get this project accomplished. And what I want to do is employ hundreds of Iraqis to build this thing themselves. Two reasons. One, the sense of accomplishment and fulfillment that it's theirs. Second, getting them doing something constructive and the self-worth that goes along with doing that, and put their passion and energy in a positive fashion as opposed to a negative one. So I couldn't agree with you more.
Mm-hmm. General,
thank you.
Yeah, thanks for the call, Karen.
Thank you, Neil.
General Garner, would you agree?
Oh, I think we should have made Karen the Minister of Trade. I think she's right on. The problem we had is, number one, we had plenty of money, but we failed to spend it. Number two, it was all controlled out of Baghdad. Number three, the people on the ground had no ability to grab that money and spend it the way they needed to. And number four, the Iraqi people, or the Committee of 25 that represented the Iraqi people, were never brought into the process for nominating projects. So she's right on. I agree with her 100%.
We are talking with two men intimately familiar with various aspects of Iraq. Jay Garner was the first U.S. administrator right after the end of the Gulf War, after the end of the invasion of Iraq and the fall of Baghdad. And Jack Keane, retired as acting chief of staff of the United States Army, just returned from an assessment trip to Iraq. If you'd like to join the conversation, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. And our email address is totn@npr.org. Later on, we'll be joined by Rajiv Chandrasekaran, the Baghdad bureau chief of the Washington Post. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's bring another caller in. Jonathan joins us from Oakland, California.
Good afternoon.
Afternoon.
I'm confused by the split in assessment between the senator, the Republican senators, Hagel, Lindsey, Lugar, and McCain, in terms of a military assessment, with Senator Hagel suggesting that we're in fact not winning in Iraq, and contrasting that with the administration's assessment in terms of how we are doing there. Mm-hmm. And I would wonder if the generals would comment on that.
Jack Keane, you were just there.
Yeah, sure. Well, I think there is an element of truth to that. It depends on what you're really looking at. Overall, I think there's tremendous progress because you do have a sovereign state and is moving towards some form of a democracy and self-rule for themselves. That's a huge step. The second thing is, there is effective training of an Iraqi security force, which at some point will bear the responsibility, the big steps. But economic development is not what it should be. Job development is not what it should be. And the foreign terrorists and the Ba'ath Party insurgents are obviously attacking us more than what they have in the past, and they have the initiative, as anybody does in an insurgency. So the security issue remains a problem, and it's going to continue to remain a problem until some of these other things take place, which will take some time.
Mm-hmm. But what about that assessment? We're not winning.
Well, it's too simple to say that. In my own judgment, if you want me to make a generalization like that, I think there's enormous progress being made, and we're moving towards a free Iraq that can secure itself and its people. And that, in that sense, we are making progress. If are we winning day in and day out on the streets of Iraq? No. That's the reality of that. And it won't change until some of these other things change. It's not enough to shoot the terrorists. That's the reality of it, because they have the capacity to regenerate. You have to change people's minds, and you're going to do that with raising the quality of life experience for them and changing that dynamic, and also giving them a chance to participate in a free Iraq. Mm-hmm. And that takes time.
General Garner, let me put that same question to you, and in the form of asking it a slightly different way, is the worst over?
Well, let me. I don't think it is yet, but let me put a more positive spin on that. I agree with what the senator's saying, and I think the administration is trying to put their best face forward. And right now, that their best face is an assessment that's a little bit more positive than it really is. But I think if you listen to what Jack Keane said earlier when he first began talking, there's a lot happening there now, and we haven't seen the benefit of that yet. You have an awful lot of good training going on with the Iraqis. You have some the top generals in the military over there right now, and they made good assessments. You see the operational tempo against insurgents increasing now. So I think probably it's going to get a little worse, but I think we're right on the cusp of our people being able to turn the tide with all the things we're bringing forth, plus the fact Negroponte is trying to stimulate the economy. You do have somewhat of a democratic process coming forward. So all those things haven't had the chance to ferment and come together in time, and they will in the next 90 to 120 days. I think that's probably when you'll see a turn and everything.
Mm-hmm. Jonathan, thanks very much for the phone call.
Can I have just quick follow-up on the economic development issue and oil being the basis for the economy in Iraq? What is the assessment for that area of the economy being secured in the prospects for that? And I thank you. I'll take my call off. Thank you.
Okay, Jonathan, thanks very much. General Keane, what have you got?
Well, it's back to where it was pre-war standards, and it's increasing every single day. Certainly they can interrupt it, but it is not a major interruption when they blow a piece of that up. I'm talking about the insurgents. There's huge infrastructure challenges out there, and there's major projects associated with that that are going to correct that over time. So progress is being made. It's gradual progress every single day in that area.
Mm-hmm. General Garner, I'm afraid we're running out of time, and we appreciate your time today. With luck, Gene will take a right turn out into the Atlantic, and all that plywood will be unnecessary.
Thank you much.
Jay Garner served as a director of the Office of Reconstruction and Humanitarian Assistance in Iraq right after the war, and he joined us by phone from New Smyrna, Florida, where he's preparing, like many people down there are, for the arrival of yet another hurricane. And, well, maybe more on that next week. We'll be back with more on Iraq after a short break. 800-989-8255, TOTN at NPR.org. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Today, we are talking about Iraq. The interim prime minister, Iyad Alawi, is in Washington. He addressed a joint meeting of Congress earlier today, held a joint news conference with President Bush. Tomorrow, he goes to the United Nations to address the General Assembly in New York. Joining us here in the studio, 3A, is Jack Keane, the former Army Chief of Staff, acting Chief of Staff of the U.S. Army. He was in Iraq earlier this month for an assessment tour. And with us now by phone from Baghdad is Rajiv Chandrasekaran. He's the Washington Post Baghdad Bureau Chief. You've heard him frequently on this program. Thanks again for being with us, Rajiv.
Good day, Neil. Good to talk to you again.
Yes. Iraq's interim prime minister, Mr. Alawi, said he was a realist, described himself that way in his speech before Congress today. You've heard his assessment of the situation in Iraq. How realistic did it sound?
Well, look, there are good things and bad things going on here. And, you know, he's right. They have security forces have made progress against insurgents in places like Tal Afar and Samarra, you can hold elections in parts of this. There are parts of Iraq, large parts of Iraq, that are not plagued by violence, particularly in the Shiite south and the Kurdish north, where one could hold elections. But there remains problem areas, as anybody on the ground here can attest to. There are still significant pockets of instability, and those pockets, as we all know, are in Sunni areas, and it's vitally important that Sunni Muslims feel a stake in a new democratically elected government, and it's vitally important that those areas get cleaned up so that elections can take place there. And I think that, one point that really must be focused on between now and January is what's the strategy going to be to make places like Ramadi and Fallujah and Baquba safe enough to hold elections? And there's the broader issue of just the sort of instability that affects everyday life here in Baghdad and in other parts of the country. There's no way to sugarcoat that. That remains a problem. And so I think the Prime Minister was trying to put his best foot forward, as is his role and what he must do when he goes in front of a joint session of Congress or appears with the President of the United States. But the fact of the matter is that there's still some incredibly stiff challenges that face him that will, I think, continue to dog us for many, many more months to come.
Is it possible for people to travel safely around Iraq today, Rajiv?
Well, it depends on who you are. If you're a foreigner, certainly not. I can remember as recently as a year ago, Neil, when, we get a report of some incident, an attack in a place like Baquba or Fallujah, and I'd jump in my car and I'd drive out there. Days of doing that for foreign journalists or for foreign aid workers, and there are precious few foreign aid workers in this country, or for contractors, are next to nil. I mean, foreigners really now must travel with a lot of armed security. For Iraqis, it's also dangerous. I mean, I can attest to the road between Baghdad and the city of Hilla, which is just about 50 miles to the south. Every day there are reports of banditry, of shooting, of abductions on that road. So many routes aren't even safe for Iraqis.
All right, let's get some more listeners on the line. We'll take a call now from, it doesn't say who it is, an anonymous caller from on line three. That's all I can say.
Hello?
Hi, you're on the air.
I have a question about, there appears to be a lot of internal pressures in Iraq. How will they suffer from external pressures from the neighboring countries like Iran and Syria, Libya, perhaps even North Korea?
We heard General Garner say talk earlier about what he described as heavy Iranian involvement in the southern Shia areas of Iraq. Did you see that, General Keane?
Well, I think there's six countries that border Iraq, and clearly Prime Minister Alawi is very sensitive to the issues that are surrounding him, and certainly the infiltration of foreign terrorists and other political influences on him. And that's one of the reasons, one of the first things he did after assuming his responsibilities was to travel to many of those countries to let them know in no uncertain terms that he's moving his country towards a democracy, and he needs their support of that, and he certainly doesn't need their meddling with it. And clearly there are political issues here. There's political interest in this area as well. I think he's going to need help from other nations in the Gulf states, in that region of the world, to sit down at some summit with these countries and work through this. I don't think the United States should head it, but I think it's in everyone's interest to work out new cooperations with this new sovereign state that will be some kind of fledgling democracy.
Rajiv, we mentioned Iran earlier. A lot of people say there are foreign terrorists coming over the border from Syria and perhaps Saudi Arabia as well.
That's right. But the two, I think, biggest challenges for Prime Minister Alawi are Iran and Syria. You guys have talked about the reports of large-scale infiltration by Iranian intelligence agents in the south, particularly in cities like Karbala and Najaf and Basra. But the key problem in terms of Sunni Islamic extremists coming through is largely from what the military calls a rat line going from the Syrian border down through western Iraq through the cities of Ramadi and into Fallujah or up towards Samarra and Tikrit. The U.S. military has mounted a number of operations on that border, but it's a long border. It just takes a lot of personnel to deal with it. They're trying to ramp up the size of the Iraqi Border Patrol, but that takes time. The interim government has been leaning on Syria. It's now a question of will the Syrian government cooperate and will they do more to stop the outflow of militants across its borders.
Okay. Let's talk now with Tatiana. Tatiana's calling from Jackson, Wyoming.
Hi. My question is sort of twofold and speaks, I guess, to the previous conversation with regard to foreigners in Iraq, but I'm curious as to what the relative security in terms of being in Iraq as a foreigner. I think probably before the war it was much easier even as an American, and your safety was probably a little bit higher. But also with regard to the levels of, say, potable water and sewer treatment and electricity and all of those things, you know, I know the administration gives a positive spin on, you know, what's going on there, and we hear a lot of negative reports. Is there some sort of statistical data with regard to what's happening there?
Rajiv?
I'll take both of those. The first one, I'll tell you, it's a night and day difference in terms of personal security. Saddam Hussein might have been an evil man. He was an evil man. I shouldn't say might have been. But in terms of safety for a foreigner in Baghdad, if you came here with an authorized visa, you know, I felt thoroughly safe moving around, and now I feel incredibly unsafe. Now, in terms of basic services, it's a mixed bag. The truth of the matter is that Iraq is producing more electricity now than it did before the war. So the administration is right when it makes that claim, but it is producing less electricity than what the United States government promised the Iraqi people it would deliver by the 30th of June. So that's where the rub is. You know, you can look at this one of two ways. You can say, hey, it's better, but you can also say, hey, we haven't done what we had set out to do, what we pledged to the people of Iraq we would accomplish. The same sorts of results can be seen in oil production, or at least in oil refining, as well as in the provision of clean drinking water to people.
And the health situation, we heard Prime Minister Alawi talking about the polio vaccines and the opening of 150 new clinics.
Well, you know, that's all well and fine, and, you know, it's good that people are getting immunized, but, you know, I go to hospitals all the time, particularly after car bombings, and I'll tell you that they are miserable, wretched places, and they're in desperate need of more supplies. And, you know, the healthcare system here before the war was abysmal. It was ruined by a dozen years of U.N. sanctions. And what little that the U.S. has done is not nearly enough, and it really needs more. And this is one key area where foreign governments and non-governmental organizations could pitch in and help, like they've done in so many other post-conflict environments. But this is also where the security situation keeps that from happening. So aid groups are not able to sort of bring the sorts of resources to bear on Iraq's healthcare system that really need to be done.
Tatiana, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you.
Okay, we're talking about Iraq. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's get another caller in. Lawrence is with us from Portland, Oregon.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. Mm-hmm. I heard Prime Minister Alawi speak earlier today saying that there are 50,000 troops combat ready, with a projection that by end of next year there should be about 250,000. If that continues to progress at that level with success, John Kerry had indicated that he wanted to have an exit plan of 4 years. How realistic is that if, in fact, they do continue to progress, to develop their own troops? And secondly, on that part,
why don't we take them one at a time, Lawrence?
Okay.
All right. General Keane, earlier you said you thought those numbers were realistic. If they are, is 4 years a reasonable exit strategy?
I don't know.
Four years is a time. It's not a strategy, but go ahead.
I would be on the column, we don't know that answer. I think we now have a very realistic training program for the Iraqi security forces and a commitment to not deploy them until we have some reasonable certainty that they'll enjoy success. And that's good news. And think about what we do. We take a youngster in the United States military, and we spend a better part of 6 months getting that youngster ready to be able to assume some responsibilities. And some skills, it takes an entire year. And then he begins to, or she begins to function in a unit, which even takes longer. But we're the most preeminent military in the world, and we do not have that expectations of the Iraqi military. But my only point is, it does take time to train an organization of individuals to be effective in a combat situation. And what we should feel good about is that there is an effective program in place to do it. And I couldn't begin to tell you, you know, when it means what that means to withdrawal of American forces. Mm-hmm. Some of that's going to depend on the Iraqi security force performance and also on the insurgents themselves. I think the death knell for the foreign insurgency that's taking place in there will be the elections. And Sigawi said it in his memo to everybody when it, I don't think he intended it to be leaked, but it got leaked. And he said if they're able to form some kind of democracy in this country, then that is it's time for us to take the jihad someplace else.
Go ahead, Lawrence. You had another point.
The second point on that was even if they do get to a point of having an abundance of troops and training, will the Iraqi people ever completely accept them because of the fact that they have been trained by coalition and U.S. troops? That seems to be a challenge with the police training and anybody else that gets training from the Western civilization seems to be completely rejected. They're blowing up their own police stations and anybody trained by us.
Mm-hmm.
Is there the reality that they will accept them?
Well, recognize, Lawrence, that the insurgents are certainly not going to accept them, and they're the ones that are doing the blowing up because they'll see them as the enemy, as they already have, and that's why they're blowing the recruits up at the police station. I've seen complete evidence of the fact that the Iraqi people, the appreciation that they have with effective police on the streets, and I mean effective by comparison to what they had in the past, which was a corrupt police force under Saddam Hussein. If you wanted a crime investigator, you had to pay for it. That's not what's on the streets now. And when the Iraqi military is on the street, the people wave at them, they cheer at them. I mean, they're very proud of the fact that that's Iraqis out there protecting them. They get a far considerable positive response than what American forces get.
Rajiv, is that your perception?
I wholeheartedly concur, and I think that if people want to see Iraqi security forces, they have most of the good people in this country really do appreciate them. And they like to see them out on the streets. One quick truth squatting thing, though, when the prime minister said that the Iraqi government now commands 50,000 armed and combat-ready Iraqis, that number needs to be broken down a little bit. About 45,000 of those combat-ready Iraqis are National Guardsmen who really have very little training. They live in the same communities in which they patrol, which means they really can't participate in aggressive operations. Only 5,000 or so of those, 6,000, are new Army soldiers. And that's the figure, as we go forward, we need to keep our eyes on. It's not the police. It's not the National Guard. It's the degree to which the U.S. military is able to train out a credible Iraqi army with special forces units, with additional armor units, and there's an aggressive effort underway to do this, and that's going to be the key here, not all these other forces that they keep talking about.
Okay. Rajiv, General Keane begs to differ on some of those numbers, but I'm afraid we're out of time, and I apologize for that, but General, first of all, Rajiv Chandrasekaran, thank you very much for your time today.
Good to talk to you.
Rajiv is the Baghdad Bureau Chief of the Washington Post. And Jack Keane, always good to have you on the program.
Thanks a lot. Enjoyed it.
Jack Keane joined us here in Studio 3A. I'm Neil Conan. This is NPR News.